Keine zwei Trader sind gleich. Ob du von Analysen oder von Instinkt geleitet wirst, Kraken Pro wurde für dich entwickelt, nach deinen Ansprüchen. Das heißt individuell anpassbare Layouts, jede Menge Trading-Widgets und nutzerdefinierte Watchlists genau dort, wo du sie brauchst. Besuche pro.kraken.com. Trading Crypto ohne Kompromisse. Powered by DLT Finance, einer Marke von DLT Securities GmbH und DLT Custody GmbH. Beide Unternehmen agieren mit Zulassung der BaFin. Lock the
gate! All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. How's it going? I know I've been doing this kind of the same way at the beginning for years, but I enjoy the consistency. I turn on the mic and I hear myself say those words and I'm in it. I'm ready to talk to you. And by the way, how is everything? Are you okay? Did you get it all done? You feeling better? Well, yeah, I mean, maybe you should like steam a little bit. Yeah. Neti pot. Did you neti pot? Did you get a flu shot? You didn't, huh? Well, I'm not going to say, look, who knows? But you know, I mean, you should probably take one day off. I mean, you probably shouldn't be at work today. Am I right? I mean, look at you. You're all covered in snot and you can't breathe and your eyes are watering and you're touching things. Maybe you should go home. You think you'll lose your job if you go home? So maybe if everybody gets sick because of you, everyone can have the day off and you're a hero, a secret hero. Who am I talking to right now? What's happening, folks? I have a couple of announcements. I do. I'm going to be doing some more small batch, artisanal, local shows here in Los Angeles, starting with a show at Dynasty Typewriter on Sunday, January 20th. And we're going to add a bunch more. That's a small space. It's a great space. It's in sort of near downtown Los Angeles. It's a little theater, and I'm going to be working through some stuff. You know, not issues, maybe a few issues, but I mean, I gotta get ready. I gotta get my head in the game. I gotta get the hour thing together and do it. You know, we've been through this before, but since I've been shooting and kind of busy, I haven't had time, so I'll do a little residency over there at the Dynasty Typewriter. I'll let you know when that is, but I do know the one gig that we have on the books at this time is January 20th. That's a Sunday. You can get the link to the tickets at WTFpod.com/tour. We good with that? Come down. You can also usually see me at the Comedy Store on the weekends, but this will be like an hour plus set. Oh, I got to find some people to feature for me. Remind me to do that. What else? Sam Lipsight is here. Sam fucking Lipsight is my guest today. Sam Lipsight is a dear friend of mine, one of my best friends. And we haven't known each other our entire life, but you know when you meet some sort of, I don't know if it's kindred spirit or when you have an understanding with somebody or where you just have such a deep mutual respect and an understanding of people. I don't know, man. I think Sam's a genius. He's a great writer. He's one of the funniest writers I know. If you like the sort of legacy of Barry Hanna, Kurt Vonnegut, Joseph Heller, Terry Southern even a bit, but just 70s style satire, fucking hilarious. Sam Lipsight. Sam fucking Lipsight. Sam Lipsight is so funny. I actually read one of his stories, The Worm in Philly, for the Paris Review podcast. Go look that up. Mark Maron reads The Worm in Philly. I loved it. It's so great to read funny material, but just also the, you know, he's so tight, man. You know, his prose is so tight and so his voice is so singular. I am happy to be friends with this man. And he's one of these guys. Sam is one of these guys. He teaches at Columbia. He's written like, I guess, four novels now. Let's see, The Subject, Steve, Homeland, The Ask, and the new one, Hark. Hark. This book is hilarious. They're all pretty hilarious. There's no doubt. He's got a collection of stories called Venus Drive and another one, I think, called The Fun Parts, is it? I think, yeah, The Fun Parts. You should read. Oh, he just wrote a story, actually, that I just read in the New Yorker, I just read a new Lipside story called Show Recent Some Love, which was hilarious. Look, some of you people trust me in terms of my taste, and I'm not misleading you. You can start anywhere. Go read the short story, the new one, and then you can pre-order the book. You can go to harkthebook.com. He's going to be touring. Sam's going on a tour. He's going to be touring bookstores in New York, Washington, D.C., Brooklyn, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Corte Madera, California, Los Angeles, Tulsa, Austin, Oxford, Mississippi, Princeton, New Jersey, Boston. You can go to harkthebook.com. You can pre-order the book. You can read some advanced praise. And you can check out his tour to go hear him read, which is hilarious. Sam is a guy that when I go to New York, we sit and talk. And this is actually, he's been on the show like three times, partially, like smaller interviews. He was there at the very beginning. He was on episode 10, he was on episode 52, and he was on episode 196, which was a live one. And none of these were a full WTF interview. Also, he was on my old radio show, Morning Sedition, quite a bunch. Anyways, me and Sam, when I go to New York, we go out to eat. We usually, lately, we've been having Greek food, and we just talk. And it's something we enjoy doing. We sit and we'll talk for, maybe an hour or so at dinner. Then we'll walk and talk for another hour, and then maybe we'll have coffee and we'll talk some more. And just let it roll. Let the thinking and laughing begin. And I've seen him through a lot of books. I think I met him right after The Subject Steve came out, and then in Homeland, he wrote a lot of that book in my old apartment, which I had left in Astoria that was pretty empty, and I just let him have it as sort of a writing zone. And I think he sat in the kitchen and wrote some of Homeland in there. And I don't know, I don't read a lot of fiction. I've had a few fiction writers on here, but very few. And every time that Sam writes a book, I get very excited, and I'm excited again. But what I'm really excited about is this is the first time that we've talked, for the whole thing, the big WTF interview with my buddy Sam Lipsight. Yeah, it's going to happen any second now. It's going to happen. I like to read some emails where somebody who is not prone to writing emails and almost like, feels like he had to write it because, it had to be done, writes me an email. Yeah, I'll read that. The subject line was a grabber, not a ball licker. I just wanted to say, and then into the body of the email. Your ability to make guests feel comfortable through your intrinsically connected experience is astonishing. Paul McCartney interview was transcendent. Robin Williams interview? They ought to put that in a time capsule. I'm just scratching the surface. Buddy Hackett's son interview? I don't think you even comprehend how good that was. I'm not going to list them off. You know how good this shit is. Let me just say this. I'm constantly amazed at how much you make your guests feel at home through kindred moments and flat-out shared experiences. I don't know any other way to put it. You rock, dude. It matters not, but I'm a 61-year-old musician from Detroit. Trust me, motherfucker, when I tell you that it takes a lot to impress me. I just feel you need to know that you have touched my soul. Paul, P.S. I have never, ever sent an email to a quote-unquote celebrity. I think it's safe to say that my record is intact. Thank you, Paul, for just feeling like you had to do that, because I'll tell you honestly, Paul, made me feel good. It may, I'll take it. I'll take it. You know, in these days where things are tentative, where the existence of the planet, I'll take it. Thank you, Paul. I'm glad I made a difference. So, all right. So I think I've told you enough about Sam. I love him as a person. I respect him as an artist. He is one of the funniest writers I know. And I'm thrilled with this new book, which I read immediately. You can go to harkthebook.com for his tour dates and for pre-order. You can pre-order it now. It actually comes out next Tuesday, January 15th. You can also check out the other books I mentioned, The Subject Steve, Homeland, The Ask, Short Story Collections, Venus Drive, and The Fun Parts, the latest story over at The New Yorker, have a few laughs. He fucking deals with all of it, and now I'm going to deal with him, and we're going to deal with us, and we're going to deal with all of it. This is me talking to Sam Lipsyte in a hotel room in New York City.
I used to sing in a rock band, so I'm used to a little bit of this.
Yeah, do you feel it coming back to you?
I feel
back when
the surge.
I
did a thing where I'd put my whole mouth over the mic and scream into it.
Oh, really? So you made that horrible distorted noise?
Yeah, exactly. And the sound technicians did not like that at all.
That was back in the days of Dung Beetle.
Dung Beetle, yeah.
Was that what it was called?
It was called Dung Beetle, yeah.
You were exploring the freedom
of
the form.
We were pushing the boundaries a little bit.
Yeah, for those few people, you pushed the boundaries.
For about 12 people.
But did Dung Beetle ever record?
We recorded a few things here and there, never a full record, but we did some singles and we were on a soundtrack for an independent film, like that.
Oh, really? What film?
It was called Half Cocked, and it came out in the 90s, and it was...
Same 12 people enjoyed that movie?
Do you remember the band, there were a lot of bands that were on the soundtrack, like the Grifters, I don't know if you remember them.
Kinda.
Yeah.
What year are we talking? I'm trying to figure out, when people ask me about music, it's sort of like, was I even doing anything but wandering around doing comedy?
I guess it was mid-90s.
Have missed the whole, I think I missed most of the 90s.
It's sort of a movie about a fictional band that gets in a van.
Oh, okay.
And goes, and then the filmmakers were in bands too, and they used songs from friends who were also in bands. And so it was kind of a celebration of a certain moment, and a sad moment maybe in American indie rock.
That moment, what is that? It was actually really just a moment. It was about a year.
It was more like 3 seconds.
For some reason in the 90s, I missed everything. Like LCD Sound System, I didn't even know they existed.
Well, they didn't exist in the 90s.
When was that?
That James Murphy.
He's a friend of yours,
right? Yeah, he is. And he worked with us and... with Dung Beetle.
He worked with Dung Beetle?
Yeah.
James Murphy did.
Yeah.
See, that's clickbait right there. That's going to break the
click
music
away.
Press. Yeah. They're just James Murphy, Dung Beetle connection.
Well, I was just with him the other night, and we were talking about who, do we listen to that music, or who even talks about that music?
Which music?
That's just whatever was going
Dung
on.
Dung Beetle?
Dung Beetle, yeah.
Is anyone right now in this world?
Is there one person
watching that movie wondering who's this band?
Is there one person playing the Dung Beetle single?
Probably not.
On a record player.
But you know what? I bet you Lady Madonna is playing somewhere.
Absolutely.
Or even like I would go as far to say that with the Beatles, maybe somewhere right now, Paperback Writer, which is a B-side, I would think, is probably playing somewhere. But Dung Beetles, what was your hit?
A hit?
Was your single?
We had a song called "The Man Went Out" that was very
The Man Went Out.
Yeah, it was very popular. It was the line was taken from "One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest." If you remember when
Chief threw the
when Billy kills himself, guess, and someone says "The Man Went Out," and that's
what it's based on.
Well, that's not what the song's about, but that's where the line comes from.
You guys are thrilled when you thought of that.
Yeah,
that's got to be a song. You
it
guys
was pretty cool. That's a song.
The man went out. Yeah.
So
what did you and Murphy decide?
He went on, of course, and became a really important rock star.
You saw him last night, and you were talking about the music. And what was the conversation?
Well, it was just, this music, these bands, what was it? Who listens to it now? It doesn't get talked about, sort of. I'm not talking about Dung Beetle, but...
You're talking about that moment.
Yeah.
Of what would you call that moment? This sort of like art, rock, punk, Matrix...
Something like that, yeah. A kind of.
Who are the other rock outfits we're talking about? Dung Beetle, the Grifters.
Well, I wouldn't even put the Grifters in there, but there was a band called Rodan. I remember.
Oh yeah,
that time.
Sure. Yeah.
There was other, a band we played with a lot was called Six Finger Satellite, and they were an amazing band.
Yeah.
We played with the Jesus Lizard at that time.
That one I heard of.
Yeah.
But now I'm that old guy. I don't know Six Finger Satellite.
They were great. And the guy from Six Finger Satellite, John McClane, went on to become, he has a group called The Juan McClane now.
Uh-huh.
But it's more like kind of dance music.
But it sounds like you're keeping up with it.
Well, I keep up with the stuff that my friends are doing now, but I don't keep up that much.
You don't listen to it, but you heard.
I listen to what they're doing.
You do.
I'm not deep in any scene or
yeah.
Like, up.
So Murphy.
I mean, I might check in on Pitchfork like every other American, but that's about it.
I didn't even know they existed. I'm surprised at how far out of the loop I really am. And I know, like, even when you just, I don't know. Brendan, like, knows a lot of things. He seems to fill his brain with stuff. But I guess you just hit random people, and they all assume, like, you know, everyone's doing that. I don't know if everyone's checking in on Pitchfork.
I don't know if they are. I mean, I'm talking about 15 years ago. I ask my son.
Like yesterday.
Yeah, I ask my son, who,
yeah.
He's 14, and he only listens to rap, I guess.
Yeah, who's this guy?
He's really into, you know, Travis Scott or ASAP Rocky or
ASAP Rocky.
He has an ASAP Rocky poster over his bed. And,
really?
And ASAP Rocky fell on him during a show, so he feels a special connection to him.
That's a life changer.
Yeah,
that's going to define things that you don't even understand yet.
No. It's shaping him deep ways. Yeah.
Well, that happens though. You never forget that shit.
No.
Like what? Do you have a music moment where you're like, you know, that's it right there? That where you had the experience, the revelation, I'm going to be a fucking punk rock singer.
Well, I think it was more, I don't know if I had, I used to scream into a hockey stick in front of a mirror when
yeah.
I was, you know, 10 or 11.
Sure.
So before I even saw a show, I was kind of imagining
yeah.
what that experience might be. But
why was there a hockey stick in the house?
Because we played street hockey in the driveway, yeah.
But, in Jersey?
In Jersey.
What part of Jersey?
Northern New Jersey.
We've covered this probably yeah. in personal conversations, but if what county?
Bergen County.
So not far from Morris County where my grandmother lived.
No.
What town?
There's a town called Klooster.
Klooster.
Which is a weird word, but it's Dutch, I think, and...
You think? You should know.
I mean, I know. It's Dutch. I'm just using that generational, I think, to sort of soften the blow of certainty.
I think there's something, as I get older, I'm starting to think that much of what's important came out of New Jersey.
Well, New Jersey is densely populated.
Yeah.
And so the chances of something interesting coming out of New Jersey are just higher.
Yeah.
Because there are just more people crammed in there.
Italians, Jews.
All sorts of people, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and then just hill people.
The hill people.
Indigenous people.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on.
And there are, you know, I keep hearing now about
how it's an old state.
Well, I keep hearing now about, because of the election, you know, there are five Floridas, I'm sure you've...
Oh, yeah.
But there are a lot of New Jerseys.
Sure.
Too, so.
On there's like five Jerseys on like a two-block radius.
Exactly.
There's several Jerseys. And it's not the same anymore. I think there was fewer Jerseys when people would have to go out into the street and walk around a little bit. But now everyone's just like bunkered in, hunkered down in their house looking at their internet. But before...
Well, now you're talking about 15 million New Jerseys or something.
Well, that's sort of what it is. Yeah, everybody's their own, you know, piece of property.
Everyone is their own New Jersey.
Yeah, their own New Jersey. Everyone is their own New Jersey. That's the new album by Dung Beetle.
Maybe Springsteen will do a guest track.
He'll do one of 1,500 guest tracks. He'll say one word. You'll sample just him going, hey, and then when people pick it out, like, yeah, we sampled that from a Springsteen. Yeah. Because, like, I guess I should, I think we met, because it feels like we've known each other for centuries, which we probably have. It's just there's some people in your life that, you know, like, you know, we go back to, you know, Rome, probably, somewhere.
Yeah.
Right?
Who, you and me?
Yeah.
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 Ancient Rome?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we were complaining. I don't think this is going to end well for the Jews.
Maybe we were Christians then. I don't know.
Maybe. That's true. Yeah, maybe we were new Christians. I don't know if this thing is great.
Well, new Christians were basically just Jews.
Right, right. So, yeah. What do we change? Do we have to change? Is it a different sandal that we... What's the big change? I just don't want to be one of the guys that's not part of the group. But I met you. Do you know what year it was?
Yeah, I do.
Really?
Vaguely. I think it was 94,
95.
It was a little later. I was, your wife and my girlfriend were friends.
My ex-wife and your ex-girlfriend were friends.
Yes.
Deborah and Kim.
Yes.
Were friends. So that was after I moved to Astoria already. I feel like it was here. We were still in New York. We were still in the city.
I think we were, but we met a few times.
Yeah.
I think we went out, may have gone on like some double dates.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And then you and I, and I was.
And then those relationships ended, but we remained friends. And then we were both in Astoria.
No, right. But like, I remember the big change.
See, what happened was Deborah and I broke up, I moved out to Astoria. That's when I moved out to Astoria.
But the bigger thing was that I remember that it was like just past mid-90s. So I didn't get sober till 99. And at that time, you were sober, and I reeled you back in. I was the Satan.
Yeah, you did.
And I feel like I should apologize for that. I should make an honest amends for making you smoke pot that day in the park.
You remember that, yeah.
I do. You probably, how could you forget it?
I remember that.
I was like, come on, man. What a fucking monster. But fortunately, and I'm happy to say that it didn't send you back.
It didn't spin me out into some terrible life after that.
No, I think you were actually appreciative of it. Like, I somehow, like, just eased you back into you realizing, like, well, maybe I'm not as bad as I was. And it turned out you weren't.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. Well, what was it? Okay, so you grow up in New Jersey. Your dad's a sports writer and a popular, well, maybe a aspiring young adult fiction writer.
Well, not aspiring, a very successful YA writer, I think.
That's what it's called, YA?
Yeah, I mean.
But what was the book that... that didn't get published? What was it? Enter the Fiddler?
Oh, that was much later. He wrote he's kind of a legend in the young adult writing world.
Isn't he also a legend in the sports?
But he's even
writing?
More of a legend as a sports writer. So,
Robert Lipsight.
Yeah, Robert Lipsight, who wrote a column for the New York Times for many years, and he was very important in the he's one of the kind of first, I don't know if first, but one of the major sports writers who really started to kind of talk about things outside of just the game, talking about
right.
the sociological, the political, the economic implications of sports. And he also, his big story that he kind of covered forever was Muhammad Ali.
Right.
And because when Ali first sort of came out and said, I'm not Cassius Clay anymore, I'm Muhammad Ali, and took certain political stands, a lot of the older sports writers started attacking him, but my dad would listen to him and took him seriously, and they formed a sort of, I'm not going to say a friendship, but an understanding, and my dad had access to Ali for many years.
Did he come over to the house?
No, like I said, it wasn't
right.
like that. But
did he go up to the training camp?
Oh yeah, no, I mean he would go and yeah. cover him at different points in his life.
And he wrote an important book on Ali.
Well, he wrote a book about Ali. He wrote a book that's just actually been reissued, and I'll plug his book. It's called Sports World, and it was first written in the 70s, but it's sort of his magnum opus about, you know, sports and society, and it's a pretty incredible book.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But I mean, but the weird thing is, like I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but
I mean, you are a little bit.
Am I?
No, I'm just kidding.
No, I'm not a sports guy.
Right.
And you're not really either.
No, I mean, growing up, I probably was into it a little more than he was. He was not really into sports. I mean, he found himself in sports.
Yeah.
But he just wanted to be a writer and a journalist and think about things. And,
right.
But he got a job at the New York Times when he was a kid, and they put him in the sports department. And I think he maybe thought he would, you know, move on to something else.
Yeah.
Politics or whatever. But
right.
he ended up staying there and building a career there. But he's not a guy who ever sat around and watched games
right.
or kept track of anyone's batting average.
Right.
Or he didn't. He liked the stories around sports, and he liked the human interest and all the other stuff. But he wasn't a nitty gritty sports fan. And when I was a kid, if I'd be, you know, on a Sunday afternoon sitting on the couch watching a football game,
yeah.
he'd come in and say, what the fuck are you doing? Why are you sitting around on your ass watching a football game? That's the dumbest fucking thing you could do with your time.
Yeah, and that's...
Did
he have a suggestion?
So everyone says to me, oh, it must have been amazing growing up with him, because you probably had tickets to everything, and he took you to every game and taught you everything about, and I said, no, you know,
he had a tremendous amount of self-loathing around his lot as a sports writer, and he had to elevate it into an intellectual exploration just to live with himself.
Well, we all do that to some degree.
Right. But so, but what was the, he told you to get off your ass, but what was the suggestion? What did he want you to do?
Well, he wasn't against sports. He was like, go out and play a sport, go out and run, go out and do something,
right?
Breathe some fresh air,
right?
Get some exercise, read a book, whatever, but don't sit and watch these professional guys bash each other on TV.
But when, so this was in Jersey?
Yeah.
And what, so you got a younger sister. Who I know, right?
Yes, yeah. Susanna.
And it's just the two of you.
Yeah.
And you're growing up in Jersey.
Yeah.
And your mom and dad stayed together for how long?
They were together till I was a sophomore in college.
Right.
And my mom was a writer too, and she during that time she published a novel and did a lot of journalism.
What's the novel?
It's called Hot Type.
Under what name?
Marjorie Lipsight.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And she was, what year was that? Was it, like, it was 70s?
In the 70s, yeah.
That time?
Late 70s.
Was it a sort of a feminist novel?
It had, yeah. I mean, it had a kind of, she was a feminist.
Yeah.
She wrote for a feminist newspaper, and it was, she had been a...
Is that first wave? Is that considered first wave?
I guess she was second wave. And she was a reporter, had been a reporter at the New York Times where she met my dad, and so she... There was a novel that was kind of autobiographical about being a young woman working in the 60s at a big metropolitan newspaper. That's what that book was about.
And is it available?
I mean, yeah, you can find it. It's not in print, but it's available.
Isn't that weird about books? Just how many there are. Like, I find that about records, too. You're like, who the fuck is this guy? And then there's one or two people who are like, that guy's the most important guy.
Yeah, no, it's... Well, it's amazing how much you can access now. You can really get everything.
So you're growing up with two writers, so you had no choice. What happened? You had a rebellion.
Well, I had a choice. I could have. I mean, my sister's not a writer.
What did she do?
She's a lawyer.
Oh, that was smarter, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got to turn and run. I mean, I tried to. What you do is you find a way to be a writer, but not the writer that they are.
Right.
You find a new path.
Right.
You hope, but.
But what was the process? Did you write in high school?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was kind of I figured out a way to write really well when I was young and get lots of pats on the head and stars on my papers. And
What were you writing early on?
Whatever I was writing.
Was there poetry involved?
Yeah, there was a little poetry. Yeah.
No, you have to. I think that the poetry is an exercise, especially when you read your prose. It's important to understand it, or to at least, I think it's important as a writer to have an experience with poetry where you're like, I see why this gets through.
Well, I think that, I mean, I had a teacher who said, if you want to write fiction, you should read poetry.
Right.
You know, you want your sound to be as close, even as a prose writer, you want it to have poetic elements. You want it to sound, you know, have a music to it.
Yeah, right.
So, I've always been going for that. I think that there was a period just in high school where I kind of learned how to write short stories. I read a lot of New Yorker short stories, and I was writing, I guess my point is, I was writing a lot of stories about experiences I didn't know anything about. I was sort of mimicking a lot of what I read.
Who were you mimicking mostly in high school?
I mean, probably the 80s minimalists at the time, you know, Raymond Carver.
Oh, yeah.
And people like that. But
can you drop some more names? I want some more names because I don't know them.
At the time, like people Raymond Carver, Bobby Ann Mason, Frederick Bartholomé.
Yeah.
And then later I discovered other writers who were more like what got called postmodernists, like Robert Coover and John Hawkes and Thomas Pynchon and people like that. But anyway, my point is I kind of learned how to write a certain kind of story and win prizes for it and stuff like that. But I kind of got disgusted with myself at a certain point because I felt like it wasn't really coming from me. I was just sort
felt like a fraud.
I felt a little like a bit like a fraud
in high school.
In college. Uh-huh. After, so I kind of turned away from the writing for a while.
So wait, so
and that's
in high
when
school,
I got into the music stuff,
the real stuff, the visceral.
Well, it was also a way for me to like scream but not be heard. Like I didn't want my words to really be heard. And
so you really turned on writing.
I really turned on writing. And then after that was when I kind of rediscovered writing for myself. When, you know, I was no longer the son of these writers. I mean, I still was, but I'm just talking about kind of that moment where you realize why you're doing something.
Yeah.
You're not doing it for other people. And you realize they don't, in the end, and this was a big lesson to me, was realizing nobody gives a shit.
Yeah.
You know, the people who love you, they want you to be happy, whatever that means.
Yeah.
And they want you to have health insurance, and they want you to, but they don't care whether, like, you write that short story that you've been thinking about or not. You know?
Right.
All the pressure that's coming from the outside.
Yeah.
Most of it's imagined. They're not.
Yeah, you're projecting all of it.
You're projecting all of it. So it was that realization that nobody cares, and that's a very liberating thought. And then it's, well, then you have to ask yourself, do I care? And if the answer is yes, then you really go.
So do you do? It seems like this is something that, those three steps. Do they care? Am I making up what I think they're thinking? And then that's step one. Yes, I am. Step two is, does anyone care?
Yeah.
Do I care if anyone cares? That's step two. Step three is, do I care? Now, this to me is a daily thing.
Yeah. I mean, some people call it prayer.
like I understand that it was.
Some people call it philosophy.
Yeah. Looking back at it, this is a moment where you remember, but I remember that from earlier today.
Yeah. Right. That was 8:30 this morning.
Yeah. Yeah, but
I'm not saying it's a one-time experience, but around writing, maybe it was daily for a while until I really got a sense of who I was in all of this.
Sure, but so in high school, you knew that this was your thing, and you had a knack for it.
Right.
You worked at it, and you aspired to it, and
I succeeded on a high school level at it.
But there's nice, Oedipal competition to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very, the other thing is realizing, you can kill your dad, but it's really exhausting.
Yeah. 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 But you can't really kill him.
No.
So when you do it that way, when you do it through.
Dads are zombies. It's true. They keep coming back.
That's true. That is true. Both of our dads are still alive, and that's a nice thing. It took me a while to realize that, but it's a good thing. But the weird thing is you can win a certain battle. Like, you can't kill, they can't eventually acknowledge, all right, so you did what you set out to do, and maybe you've eclipsed me a little bit, but that doesn't really kill them, because once you get past that, you're still looking at them, and in their mind, they're like, I'm still here, fucker.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not dead yet. How you doing? Yeah. I went through what you're going through, all the other stuff.
Raging Bull was on TV the other night. Oh. That moment where he's like, you never put me down, Ray.
Never
put me down.
Never knocked me down, Ray. Just insanity. And Ray's just looking at him like, all right,
that's
weirdo.
That's the relationship.
That's fathers and sons.
Yeah, exactly.
So early on, you weren't like me, at some point I was like, I'm not going to college. But, I just was, kind of locked into some sort of towny dream for a minute there until I panicked. But growing up with not academics, but people who put a premium on, intellectual activity, were you ever one of those people where you're like, I'm done? You always knew you were going to go to college.
I kind of wanted to go to college because I thought it would be a way to get out.
Right.
It was a nice town I grew up in, but I was ready to go somewhere else and meet some other people. And I had this fantasy that turned out to be just that, when I went to college, everyone would be interested in the things I was interested in and care about what I cared about. And there were a few people, but then there were a whole bunch of other assholes too, just like anywhere else.
Right. Of course. And you went to Brown?
Yeah.
See, I didn't have a lot of choices when I, decided to go to college, and there was, and Brown's an Ivy Leaguer, right?
Yeah, I think it's known as a minor Ivy.
Minor Ivy. But it's also known as this sort of heavily liberal arts kind of a celebrity children thing.
Right. Well, especially when I was there, this was the 80s and it was, getting covered in the media as the hot school, and people hadn't really paid attention to Brown before, but suddenly.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were celebrity children. The royalty was there. There was,
So it was a place.
In the student phone book, it said, with somebody's name and then just comma and then Princess of Greece.
Oh, really?
Stuff like that.
But this was, But it was for it, I wouldn't.
I mean, sometimes you ran into those people, and sometimes you didn't.
But it wasn't. But see, the thing is, that's always been the case with Ivy League schools, like Yale and Harvard, have always been sort of like the educational facility for aristocracies and tyrants and dictators' families, and it was a place to get everybody the good education. But it seemed like Brown was sort of like, we got this one bad kid.
Yeah,
this princess is problematic.
It was for like ruling class fuck ups. There's definitely there was some of that, and then there was a kind of intellectual kind of, you know, clove cigarette smoking kind of thing going on there, maybe more than at some of those other schools. It was very big into there was a semiotics department and there was theory, and so you went in there immediately without, you know, really any context. You were reading all of these French deconstructionists and getting into some, if that was your kind of major, if you were kind of an English major kind of person.
Oh, so they, because of the nature of the school and that it was more, it seems like the regimen was different than some of the bigger Ivy League schools.
Right. Well, you weren't necessarily like, I feel like Harvard, Yale, Princeton, you're really being trained to run the world.
Right.
And Brown, it was like you were there to be the black sheep.
Right.
Relation of the person who ran the world.
I never became a disciplined intellectual of any kind. Like, I don't, you know, I understand the words you're saying, and I think I have an idea in my mind of what they mean, but I did not, I got no training. So when you say postmodern and deconstruction, you could probably explain it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that interesting.
But for years, I was sort of like, why don't I know about that? I was the guy that, you know, I didn't fuck off in college. I did well. I graduated with honors to a certain degree, and I cobbled together a English degree. But like when it came right down to it, I was on the Lower East Side in the late 80s and early 90s with all the semio textbooks.
Trying to put it together. Yeah.
But without any sort of guidelines. Right. So like I'm reading this book now by this guy David Shields, and there's an element to it there that he clearly comes from that, and I'm having the exact same experience. I enjoy reading the lines and I think I have an idea of what he's saying, but obviously there's a whole context, not unlike the language of philosophy, where he knows exactly what he's saying and I'm just sort of like, I kind of get it.
Well, I mean, I felt that way coming into college. I was given these texts and I didn't really have a way to relate to them, and some of it was mind-blowing and some of it was really alienating.
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know, I wasn't coming from the ruling class, so I couldn't, you know,
fuck off,
but I tried to take it seriously, but I was trying to grasp it all, and some of it, you know, I think I absorbed some, and some of it definitely helped shape my worldview, but it was kind of a general, I mean, it was not that different from, you know, any kind of vaguely Marxist progressive worldview you might get.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
And there were definitely levels that I didn't get to.
Well, because if you do get to those levels, then it becomes your job to sort of continue pursuing the depth and range of those levels. Like, you know, I imagine if you get to a certain level of understanding of that kind of stuff, you're required to commit your life to it.
It becomes a kind of priesthood or something.
Right. Yeah. That as time goes on, no one gives a fuck about it.
Right. And it's losing traction even.
Yeah. Which even is the Church of the Deconstruction.
Yeah.
The deconstructivist.
I mean, this stuff's been around for 30, 40 years. It's not, you know, people rage about it now and people rage against the postmodernists now. It's not like the postmodernists are running
anything.
So I don't understand all of the.
I'd like to meet some of the people that are raging. See, like it's sort of like.
I'm thinking of, you know, even if you look at people who are getting a lot of attention now, like a guy like Jordan Peterson, if you're aware of that guy, you know, and he will rage against the postmodernists. And I think his feeling is, you know, it has filtered down into the identity politics and all of that. But
it probably has.
But I mean, I feel like that's just kind of a straw man in a certain way.
It's a straw man, and it's also like a bit of pseudo intellectual hodgepodge that is making it that has been made accessible to the people who are, you know, pretty fucking stupid in terms of education, but now have become enabled through language and through funneling it through their own anger to kind of like make half baked arguments with the proper language. And then it becomes really problematic.
Yeah, I mean, people are just throwing terminology around to
right.
rile up
Well, now when you have a sort of
audience,
right, and then you have a certain group of people that are able to say that, you know, actual facts are a good theory.
Yeah,
it's, then it becomes problematic. But I don't think we should get lost into that shit. So, but I do want to talk about the relevance of writing, because, you know, you and I are not, you're a little younger than me, but like obviously our heroes are in the same sort of time zone. But like when did you start, was it when you got to Brown that you started really to sort of dig into the guys that informed your writing the most?
Well, I think when I was in college, I definitely encountered a few writers that would have a lasting impact on me. Writers like Barry Hanna,
yeah,
Stanley Elkin,
yeah,
Grace Paley, Thomas McGuane. And then I became very much a fan of I discovered a journal that was coming out called The Quarterly that was being edited by a guy named Gordon Lish, who was a famous New York City editor.
Yeah.
He had edited Raymond Carver. That was very controversially. But so I started sending stories to this magazine. I just wanted to get in, and I'd get these really nice rejection letters, and I just kept sending.
From Gordon himself?
Yeah. And, he'd write little notes, just keep trying or keep going. Yeah. But, and so that encouraged me to keep going. And so even while I was doing the band stuff, I was still harboring a little desire to get involved with this. And then eventually after kind of things, my life kind of fell apart and I was rebuilding.
Wait, so we can't just like that. That's not the thing you just kind of skirt over.
I know. Yeah, I was going to backtrack to it, but.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So after your life fell apart.
Well, a bunch of things happened. The band fell apart. We got involved with drugs.
We didn't get to the beginning of the band. So the band starts at Brown?
A little bit after. Yeah.
So you're at Brown.
We're living in Providence and we're doing this band.
And you're like sitting around smoking cigarettes, being angry, sweating over mirrors and lines of cocaine.
No, not really. There was no coke, really. It was just like beer and cigarettes.
Yeah.
And playing at local clubs and hanging out.
But who was the guitar player?
A guy named Rob Reynolds.
Uh-huh.
Who's now a painter in L.A. and a really good friend of mine. But
is he a good painter?
He's a very good painter.
Big painter?
He paints big and small.
Abstracts?
He does all sorts of things. He does some abstract things and some figurative things too.
I wonder if he knows my girlfriend.
He might.
So he's a painter. And so who was on drums?
A guy on drums was his name was Bruce Cooley, but we called him Bruce Oyster Cooley. And
sure,
he
just Oyster sometimes.
Just says Oyster. he had been actually our TA in a class, but we kind of dragged him into this.
Oh, yeah.
He was a little bit older.
Yeah.
And then on bass, we had a guy named Nicholas Butterworth.
Sure.
And although he went by Big Jimmy Fingers at the time. We all had rock names.
What was your rock name?
Sam Shit.
Sam Shit? Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Or Sam Beetle, because it was Dung Beetle, but I sort of did both.
So the birth of Dung Beetle, they were all RISD guys? Or no, they were all Brown guys?
They were all originally Brown guys.
Uh-huh. And what was the manifesto?
Well, the manifesto was just to be kind of weird and crazy and never wink at the audience, never let them know that it was a joke.
Oh, okay.
That just seemed very important to us. So.
Uh-huh.
And just kind of to be as alienating as possible while still being entertaining.
Uh-huh.
like we wanted you to have a good time, but, to feel bad. Feel disturbed on some level.
And did you have a following?
Well, those 12 people we talked about.
I know, but it was really just 12? Or like,
yeah, people would show
up. You were part of a scene.
We were part of a scene. Like I said, there was a band, Six Finger Satellite, other bands. Yeah, yeah. We were in Providence, and then we moved the band down to New York after about a year.
But you were still at Brown?
No, we were done. We had graduated. So
I see.
So after Brown was over, we spent a year in Providence playing around in clubs there.
So you did your degree.
Yeah.
And you wrote your stuff. You got through Brown with a degree in what?
English.
Yeah.
English major.
And you'd publish some stuff during college?
Just, no, not really. College magazines, maybe, but nothing.
Okay. Yeah. And afterwards, you're like, we're a band, and we're going to New York.
We spent a year in Providence.
Okay, and then
we went down to New York.
It was serious.
Yeah, we were serious. I mean, I don't know what we didn't know. It's not like we were serious, like we thought we were going to end up on TV with this, but we were serious about wanting to keep playing and keep playing in clubs
and keep pushing the envelope with the fuck you-ness.
Well, finding interesting ways to say fuck you, because it's easy to say fuck you in a boring way. But
so, who were the musical influences? If we were to listen to Dung Beetle, we'd be like, oh, you know, this sounds a lot like,
well, the Osmonds. I don't know.
You must have seen yourself on some sort of continuum.
Yeah, I mean, it was punk rock. It was, but it was, I mean, also we were all coming from different places, but, you know, we liked bands like the Laughing Hyenas, like the Gun Club, if you remember.
Oh, the
that.
Gun Club. Yeah. I love the Gun Club.
The Jesus Great Lizard.
The Gun Club was so good.
Yeah. The Stooges we loved.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So
yeah.
It's that kind of, if you can find that then.
So when did the wheels start coming off?
After about I think that a couple of us started to be interested in other things, you know, started to think about, the guitarist was thinking more about painting at a certain point. The bassist was thinking about politics and we just started, we started to lose a little bit of steam, and we started to lose that, that team feeling that I think we had.
And drugs were getting involved.
People,
you got all fucked up.
I got pretty fucked up. And
for how long?
Not that long, but long enough for it to you know, screw up my life.
Did you get scared?
Yeah.
were you like, I don't know how much you really want to talk about it. I'll be diplomatic about it. But were you strung out?
I mean, there were not for long periods, but for good enough periods, I was, you know, yeah, thinking about what am I going to do today to get the money to not feel shitty.
Right.
Let's put it that way.
And that became the job at times.
That became, you know, a full-time job.
And what did you do for the money to get the stuff to not feel shitty?
Sell stuff. Sell my belongings.
Oh, yeah?
You know.
So he's getting sparse?
Things got good. I mean, and we knew things were going bad when the drummer started selling his drum kit one piece at a time. So claiming that it was, you know, because he was into a more minimalist sound, but...
A more minimal sound of just what's going on in his head in the corner of the empty room. Really, so it got down to just the snare.
Exactly.
You're like, this has got sort of a military feel. I don't know if that's what we're looking for.
Right.
So but it got to a point where you're like, I've got to clean up.
Yeah.
And you did it.
Yeah.
And that's when you started to rethink the writing.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of was doing all sorts of things to make money, including substitute teaching at high schools, and I was, and this is also a point where my mother had been in remission from breast cancer for about 13 years, but came back, and it got pretty bad, and I was sort of rebuilding my life, and she was in this bad place, so I moved in with her.
In Jersey?
This is now my parents had divorced, and they both lived in the city.
Uh-huh.
And so I kind of took care of her.
Oh.
And was trying to take care of myself at the same time.
Right.
And it was a kind of an amazing time. I'm glad it worked out that way, that I was able to be there.
Well, it's good that you were sober and not taking her medication.
That was a good...
Could have gone the other way.
It could have gone the other way, but the timing was right. So I was a help rather than a hindrance. And
so really, you nursed
and her? We helped each other.
Yeah.
You know? And then,
what do you mean, how so? Just by
talking? Well, emotionally, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Being there for each other. And then, and she, you know, but it, you know, she got sicker and sicker, and then she died.
Yeah. And you were there the whole time?
Yeah.
You were the primary caretaker in a way?
Yeah.
Wow. I can't, like, yeah, it's, And what effect did that, I mean, it must have been, like, I assume, because I can only, you know, speculate, but, like, to sort of process that and go through it, it must have brought you closer and given you a deeper understanding of something.
Well, I mean, it gave me a deeper understanding of her.
Yeah.
Which I was really grateful for, because, you know, she'd been my mom and, you know, whatever, a lot of other, you know, and I'd known her in so many ways, but now I kind of got to know her in a new way and kind of understand her as a person.
Yeah.
A lot more, you know. I'm sorry that it took this for that to happen, but.
But you had, you sadly, but also in some bittersweet way, you had the time.
Yeah. And we did have, there was time. It was, you know, it was a period of a couple of years. So.
And you probably, because of like what you just, the identification probably was so strong with your dad. After a certain point, you detach from your parents and you realize like you have no idea who they are.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
And you were able to sort of know her.
Yeah.
That's great.
Know her. And in a way, I'm getting to know my dad now in a way that I wasn't able to before when I was filled up with all sorts of feelings and resentments.
Yeah. Resentments and, you know, independence. And,
yeah,
and like,
yeah. Sort of necessary defiance or
right.
distancing or whatever.
Pushing back.
Pushing back. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but that was a very key, I think, moment in my life was that time with her.
Yeah.
And then after that, but you know, I really didn't start to really write seriously and write the things that I would eventually publish until after that.
Yeah.
She died. And then I was kind of, then in a strange way, that was the final, like, well, nobody really, the only person who really truly gave a shit is dead now. So now
it's on you.
Now it's on me.
Do I give a shit?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who am I doing it for?
Yeah.
But it must have, like, I imagine that experience kind of helped humanize and define the darkness a bit, right?
Yeah.
You know, because there is sort of, like, there's that one short story where the junkie dude shoots up his mother's ashes.
Right.
That, like, the, you know, I imagine it would be hard to think of that comedic device, if you could call it that, or make it sort of poignant and funny without having the experience that you had both with your own life and with your mother passing.
Right. Away. And I mean, that was a important story for me to write at that time.
What was it called?
Cremains. And, but I think that my experience had been, I'd been kind of at that point anyway, sort of a good son.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to write that. That's
right.
Not interesting.
Yeah.
So I was
been done.
I was more interested in writing about, you know, what it was kind of a story. It was almost like an alternate history of what if I had, you know, stayed on a bad course.
Right.
And had the same
right.
things experienced with my mother. You know?
Right.
So that was kind of the imaginative
right.
leap.
Yeah. That's a good one.
And I didn't know I was writing the story. I've told this before, but I was writing it and I didn't know where it was going. And then as soon as he shot up his mother's ashes, I was like, oh, I guess it's over. I guess like,
where you go from there. Yeah,
exactly. I guess the story's
You've
over.
You've done it. It sort of circles back around to what I keep circling back around to without saying is that, you know, when I talked about our own heroes and about who they are, when you talk about people like Stanley Elkin or Barry Hanna or Dennis, what's his last name?
Well, I mentioned Thomas McGuane, but
McGuane.
Were you going to say Dennis Johnson? He definitely,
yeah, Dennis
that
Johnson.
That book was certainly
an McGuane,
amazing
of course.
Thing to read.
But these guys, like, and you know, I brought up, what did I bring up with you? Oh, the Brodigan book I dug
yeah.
up and I was, but like these guys were this pantheon of these 70s writers.
Yeah.
You know, who like to a certain group of people were you know, incredibly important and culturally relevant. You said you went to Philip Roth's memorial, right?
I did go to
that. Yeah. And like I just wonder, like, you know, how they defined culture when they were alive, because it seemed like there was a good part of culture that was sort of intellectually bent.
Well, I guess you mentioned the 70s and you think about books and movies and all of it together. It's this, there's a kind of cultural feeling that I guess we both feel steeped in and feel formed by. And definitely, you know,
we grew up in it.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, but it was really the 70s. I was paying, you know, had been done in the 70s. That was, what I was marinating in.
Yeah. And then when you like, I guess like in terms of like your own books, that there's this idea, like I know who the writers, some of the writers are that are in the world that you're in, your generation or whatever. And even the ones that are really big, you know, it's still sort of, it seems like an insulated community. Like when you say someone's a priest of deconstructionism, right, that there's still this world of literature that I feel like gets more and more, you know, specific and insulated. You know what I mean? That it doesn't have the cultural resonance that it once had.
That's really true. And I always say, you know, I think there was a time when, you know, there was a particular book or a particular movie or a particular record that, you know, when you went to the party, you just had to at least pretend to have experienced. And I think that that's still true, except the book is off the table. You don't have, there's no you never have, you don't have to pretend to have read a book at this point.
Well, no, it seems right. That's
or
true.
Or a novel, anyway.
No, I think that's true. But also, I think what's happened is instead of having a common conversation about this thing that's supposedly important, it seems like the real you know, conversational premium is knowing something about something that no one knows about. Like, you know, sort of like, oh, you didn't see that? It's like, I didn't even know it existed. Oh, of course you didn't. Like, there's, a, it's not.
Right.
You know, but maybe in the world you run in, that, that's still with movies or whatever, but it seems more that people, like, there's no common thread that, you know, there's so much shit
well,
out
no,
there.
Well, no, we're all in our niches. That's all.
Right. Like, then the niche can be very small.
Yeah. And so there's no common thread. There's no main narrative we're all commenting on. I mean, besides the political one,
which right,
all,
right now.
We're all, that's
yeah,
what,
but that's just
that's what we're all looking
recent.
At. Recent, right? You're into these books, you're into right. these movies, and they or, and these books over here, and they don't necessarily touch each other.
Well, I think that's what like that's what's great about the new book, Hark, about the new novel is because you know having watched you go through the other novels, The Subject Steve, the first one. Well, first is Venus Drive, right? The
yeah,
stories.
Yeah.
And those are stories and they're great and they're dark and they're, you know, they're solid. But then Subject Steve is not as accessible as Homeland, right? It's a little like fragmented, not yeah. in a bad way, but you were doing something.
What was I doing? what was I doing?
Well, no, I mean, I think like, see, like I, there, like when I read Elkin or I read some of these other guys, like Elkin is not really an easy read.
I mean, one writer I didn't mention that I think The Subject Steve was probably indebted to is DeLillo. I mean,
DeLillo's the greatest. Yeah. Right, right. He's another Lish guy.
Well, they were friends. I mean, I wouldn't say Lish really shaped DeLillo, but you know.
And Welbeck,
but like a book
right?
like White Noise or something, you know.
Sure. Yeah. Right. White Noise. Yeah, exactly. That was the first DeLillo I read, and then I read all of them at yeah. a certain point. But that was the one that really was his big. Finally, that was what his fifth novel, probably
something like that, yeah.
Because the other ones, it's just right. So fragment's not the right word. I don't know how to talk about novels that much, but it wasn't insanely accessible.
No, I mean it was trying to do certain things, as you said. It was structured in a weird way. It was these kinds of diary entries or these itemizations they were called,
yeah.
And so I was trying to. Get to a lot of it was doing a more kind of cultural analysis than some of the other
right
books maybe
but I think now you've come back to it but your voice is so you know well defined and also I think more broad
yeah I mean I think yes I see what you're saying I think you're I agree with you I think there's a bit of the Subject Steve in Hark but with more of the character stuff and more
right.
of the human stuff
right
brought in
and more funny
and funnier.
Yes. Yeah, cuz they like all the comedies the characters are very well defined and the humor because the characters are not only believable but familiar and sort of well defined yet the humor has a lot more punch to it.
Well, thank you.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I mean I'm going for that. That's the effect I'm after.
So in your personal arc like cuz I've just watched cuz like Homeland was funny. But like
Homeland was really driven by this ridiculous voice.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was a very funny.
Right. Because the guy had a chip on his shoulder.
He had a chip on his shoulder and it was about like reading through his bombast. And
yeah.
Through his mania.
Right. And then the ask we get into this other world where you're sort of like, you know, you've got the guy that's trying to, you know, make it, you know, just survive life. And he's in this weird world of servicing rich people.
Yeah, so it's just kind of like this walk of shame through the whole book. This kind of series of humiliations that reflect, I think, what a lot of people feel in their working life and their.
And I think in that book that The Ask, which I loved, but I just see the natural evolution of sort of like dealing with the ideas that you like to deal with, but like somehow or another, the characters become. Like I in this book, as I told you before, like I'm not going to mistake you for the
right.
main guy. In The Ask, I'm like that's Sam, and then there was actually a part where like that's actually a conversation I had with Sam.
Yeah, that's true.
I never tell anybody. I'm not particularly proud of where I was at that time, but that beat that you used in the book was hilarious. That's not a problem I'm having. I don't even want to tell people which one it is. They can figure it out. But this book, the guy, what's the protagonist's name? Hark, the other guy.
Fraz.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I can see.
There are aspects of me in there, like, it's a lot of different people. And I don't mean that in that usual fiction writer evasive way of don't pin me down. I am drawing from a lot of different.
Sure. The experience of being married and having two children.
But there's emotional autobiography there, right? You know, it's.
Right.
A lot of those feelings are feelings I've had. The situation's not so much.
But I just feel in this book, I guess not unlike, you know, White Noise in a way, that you were able to sort of get it all in, you know, get, you know, politics, culture, you know, spirituality, the exploitation of spirituality, right. Commercialism, you know, all these, you know, tech, yeah. You know, like that, the entire, you know, sort of chaotic but defining cultural landscape that we're living in, which seems really hard to wrap your brain around. You were sort of able to harness it. Through this, he's not even a charlatan. He's almost a haphazard spiritual leader.
Yeah, I mean,
right?
Yeah, and then there's a kind of revelation at the end about who he really is. But
yeah, but, and it was very satisfying. And to me, that's the trickiest thing. And I think I don't know, not as somebody who talks literature much or claims to even you know study it, but it seems that when you're dealing with a novel that has you know, definable characters, that's not abstract, that third act is the trickiest one. How are you going to end that
fucker?
How
do you land it? Yeah.
Yeah. But like you landed it great. Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, that was a leap, as they say. You know, that was, should I do this? That was a moment where I thought, if this is wrong, I'm really fucked.
No, but it was satisfying because, like I said, like from before in talking about poetry, that if you have laid the groundwork, I think there, in again, not an academic, but you know, you have a certain amount of freedom with poetry to the point where you know a lot of times you can't determine whether it's terrible or it isn't, right? But you'd laid all this groundwork, so to take the leap that you took. You know, just poetically is sound. Like, yeah. You know, whether or not the logic is going to hold or if it's believable doesn't really matter, does it?
No, I think that it's, I mean, what you're talking about is just a general storytelling idea, which is do you earn it or not?
Right. Yeah, but you earned it and you're sort of like, I guess he's going to do it that way. Yeah. That's fine. That's great.
Good.
Yeah. And,
but yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I was trying to, it took me a long time to write this book. I started it in 2012.
Really?
And so it wasn't something it was something that was, I kept layering things into it and it changed a bit as I went and my conception of even what it could be altered a lot. And I like that it took a while and I like that those layers are there. It creates more texture and creates more space for all of those themes you mentioned and also creates, or allowed me to work on those characters and make them as dimensional as possible.
Yeah, and I think they're the comedic device of it, a lot of them that kind of move throughout the book, the changing names of local restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, it does sort of, it kind of guts the reality we live in a little bit. And that we're all such suckers for such bullshit, you know, so daily. It almost seems to change every day. But you know the sort of what really the continuum the thing that stays is like you know Fraz's problems,
right?
You know, and his particular character, you know, his emotional problems and his you know his sense of insecurity, that no matter what is shifting around you or how complicated the world gets, is that at the end of the day you're still that guy.
You're still you. Yeah.
But like what elements, like, you know, Gordon Lish is this sort of kind of infamous character who ran these writer workshops.
Yeah, I mean, they were, yes.
Is that the word, wrong word?
No. I was thinking about workshop because he didn't go over your writing that much in these classes. He more lectured and spoke about writing and then sort of, it would go for about 6 hours each session. And then at the end, he'd ask people to read from whatever they were working on. And it was a very nerve-wracking experience.
Is he still alive?
Yeah. And he would listen to what you were writing but really point out immediately where you were going wrong. And
he was harsh. And he wear military garb too or something?
It was safari garb maybe. It was
He was a character, a New York character that had written a lot of books.
Well, he wrote a lot of books. He edited almost all the writers I cared about at some point or another. And he, when he was editor at Esquire and Knopf, he published most of the writers I care about. So he was someone that I looked to as, this is a guy who had already helped shape what I thought was some of the most exciting writing in the last 50, you know, whatever, 40 years of American fiction. So he was an incredible, and he still teaches a little bit, I think, but maybe he hasn't in a while, but he was an incredible teacher. He really gave of himself. He gave everything he had. He had the most best ear I've ever encountered. He could hear everything you were doing. And he taught you how to really, I always say, he taught us how to listen to ourselves, mm-hmm. which was the most important thing. Because I think that before then, one is writing and one sort of doesn't even, one writes and writes, but isn't even paying attention to what you're doing.
Right.
You're and trying also, to get to the next thing and you're not staying in the moment.
Or else you're sort of elaborating to a degree where you're entertaining yourself, but not necessarily honoring what you want to say.
And what you've put into motion. The idea is you begin with these elements and you have to follow them. And you can't, if you're going to veer away from them, you have to account for that. And,
right.
And the thing that I have found, which is what I like about what I do, is I get to, when I begin, write a first draft, that's an improvisation.
Right.
And that's like, that's a performance.
You're talking about a 200, 300 page performance?
Yeah. But then you get to fix it. You get to keep working on it and keep fixing it and revising it.
Yeah.
And so you get the best of both.
So with something like with Hark, where did that start? What was the driving idea?
I think I began with this idea, this kind of silly idea of mental archery. You know, just this image of people doing these.
So this is your sort of satirical riff on yoga.
All that stuff. Yeah, I mean, and my wife is really into yoga, and we talk about this kind of stuff all the time.
Right.
And, you know, I've tried to do it, and you know, maybe I was thinking of a yoga I could do, which mental archery
Well, the thing that's so funny about it is that you sort of, you know, flesh it out enough to, you know, historically with bullshit and actual facts that you created a history for this idea.
Yeah.
That becomes a spiritual idea.
That was a lot of fun. That part of it, sort of naming the poses and doing the historical background on all of them.
And also, it's vague enough to be, you know, open to almost any interpretation.
Right.
Which is, you know, how
which
this
is
guy
the secret to a lot of these things. Yeah.
And how this guy becomes put in the position of being a spiritual guru.
Well, the idea of Hark himself is he's someone everyone can project upon. And so different characters have a different idea of what mental archery is and what it means and what it can mean for them and for society. So some people see it as a more private practice, a more spiritual private practice. Yeah. Other people see it as an agent for political change.
Yeah.
Other people see it as a way to bring communities together. And everyone, you know, everyone's projecting onto Hark. Some people see him as, you know, Hark, this kind of old style shaman. Some people see him as this, you know, new leader. But everyone,
and then there's the forces of capitalism and technology that want to exploit it.
Swooping in to commodify it. Yeah. So he's, you know, one of those guys who can be everything to everybody.
Right. Yeah. Except like, who is he?
Who is he? And he's just like, I don't know.
It just reminded me.
Well, he says, I just want to help people focus. That's what he keeps saying in the book. And everyone's heaping all of his other stuff on top.
Everything will be good
in the garden. Yeah. It's a little like, being there. He's a little bit of a Chance the Gardener type.
Yeah. I just thought of that when we were talking. But so it started out with mental archery. That was the idea. Yeah, that came to you in a flash of some kind.
Yeah, mental archery, and then somebody kind of teaching it, going somewhere upstate to do a seminar.
And that was the basis.
That's what triggered it all. And then I was writing that. There was a whole scene that didn't make it into the book. That was maybe the first thing I wrote. But then I realized that this guy Hark needed some kind of sidekick, and then that's where the Fraz character came in. And then I had this other storyline.
The initial hanger on.
Yeah.
The guy who saw something in it for himself.
Right.
but spiritually and like it defined his life.
He's feeling this lack.
Yeah, a lack.
And he needs to plug into something. And yeah, here it is.
The lack.
and then I also, there's another subplot about someone who transports organs around.
Oh, yeah.
And I met this guy who is a German actor who does this, you know, he does acting jobs all around the world, but then he's also transporting organs all over the place. Hmm. It's kind of his side gig.
Yeah.
And I became interested in sort of that
right, there's practice. A little subplot there.
And so there's a woman who's one of the main characters is also transporting organs at different points.
It's so funny that out of the entire book, I would have thought that would have been the one contrivance, but that's actually rooted yeah, in right. a guy you met. Like, where the fuck did this come from? And you're like, a German guy. And then you just sort of move through the rest of it. I mean, like, because I remember talking to you once before about where you start and you kind of start in the middle and build out.
Well, there was a little, I mean, because of that scene, you know, wasn't necessarily the beginning of a story. It was showing them already established in their routines.
Right.
So then I'm like, who are these people? What are their lives like? Where did they come from? That's the building out. You sort of figure out and what's going to happen.
Right.
And so that takes a long time. And so I always say I kind of am writing sideways because I'm moving forward, but then I'm always going back and playing with what I've done and then moving forward again and going back and moving forward. So it's kind of this sideways crab-like movement. It's not a straight shot.
Sure, of course, right. But what's also interesting is because of the time that this evolved over whatever, what is it, 5 years, 6 years?
Yeah, six years.
Is that you were able to integrate a lot of the cultural dialogue that's going on around, you know, gender and around, feminism and around, paradigm shifting.
Yeah.
You know, active, patriarchic takedown. That it's not like a full subtext, but you address it, like, because I think there's a lot in this book that is very immediate and relevant cultural commentary in a very cutting but funny way,
And I think it's stuff that was bubbling for a while and in the air, and it's not
you didn't wedge it in there.
I didn't wedge it in there because these characters were kind of naturally talking about this stuff.
But
then I started to see, oh, this thing's heating up and that aspect's heating up. Yeah.
Yeah, there was very few things that you didn't really touch upon, I think. I think you got it all in. I think you did it.
So I'm done.
Yeah. No, now you go back to much simpler things. Now you just sort of, now it just becomes about you on a beach for a while. Now you got to, like, because I think, I don't know what you have to do. This book is just coming out. What do we got to talk about the next one for?
Oh, there is no next one. Yeah.
That's
it? No, I'm just saying, no, I mean, I hope there's a next one, but yeah, I feel empty right now.
Right.
You got to spend a little time filling back up.
I was just so, proud of you and excited, because I always love reading your books and I always get a big kick out of them. But there, as I know you as a person and also as an artist, that, when you see somebody just sort of go like, oh, this was the next one. This is the one that, it's all fully realized. Yeah. I'm not saying you're done, but I'm saying that.
No, like, I want to feel like the worst feeling is, oh, the third book was the best. And I've just been on this downward. I mean, and you're always going to meet people who like different books that you've written. So.
Right.
But you want to feel like...
Yeah, but don't trust those people.
No, you want to feel like this is, I'm as good as I can be now.
Right.
And I'm...
Exactly.
I'm the best I've been now. And this is as good as I have done. That's what you want to feel like.
Right. But, that's weird for people like me and you, and maybe, I don't know, really for you. But, like, I know, even if I did my best effort in the past...
Yeah, you're...
At the time, that it wasn't there yet.
Right.
I know that I don't tell people that necessarily, but when I look back on my choice to do Thinky Pain as a loose sort of hour and a half exploration of things that, some of which were not fully realized but that's what I wanted it to be.
Right.
I don't think it was a cop out or a rationalization. That was just how I was working at that time. And now, after I did that, I'm like, well, I'm going to tighten it up.
Right. Yeah.
That was a good experiment. I'm glad people like it. It had its own quality to it, but I got to tighten it up.
Yeah. And there's also this sense, when you look back at the end of everything, people are trying to make a story out of your career and
yeah.
everything you did. And, oh, it went this way and built this way and yeah. reached this pinnacle. But that's not how you're feeling. You're just feeling like, now I want to try this. And now I want to do this. And now
right.
I want to go out in this direction. And yeah. then I want to go out in a different one. And so you're not thinking of the arc of your biography when you're making all these choices about what you're working
not,
on.
Not insane, insecure, creative people. Ambitious people that are able to project what they want their life to be and their career to be, they seem to do that. But I don't have that luxury.
You're not saying, you know,
no.
What would Marc Maron do now?
No. Sometimes I wish I had more of that.
Yeah, I mean, that would help, actually. It's true.
Some people, they lock in. They're like, this is what I do good, and yeah. I'm going to keep doing this because it's right. making me money or whatever.
And this is what people want.
The benefit for us is that, like, you know, we haven't locked into something that makes a lot of other people money. You know,
right. You know. So you're not feeling that pressure.
Like, yeah. You're not, from us or other or the outside.
You're not supporting a lot of families.
Right. Well, that's it. Yeah. I've always listen. I hate when I say I've always said that. You know, you don't make money until you make other people money.
That's the sign that you're making money, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've sort of gone around that, so that worked out. You know, like I don't have to answer to anybody, but that we're not talking about me.
We can though.
No, I'm tired of it. Well, let me ask you this, because like you know, you teach, like the you know, the one route that people take, you know, in your racket is that you know you haven't act like, again, this speaks to, you know, that planning, or you know, what are you going to do with your talent that you know that you have, and you haven't really sort of succumbed to this sort of Faulknerian, you know, journey to Hollywood.
I mean, when people like me, you can write for TV,
yeah.
You can teach.
Yeah.
You used to be able to get by on journalism doing magazine stuff, but that's kind of contracting and it's not really viable anymore. So people are really, it's television or teaching.
Yeah.
And I mean, I have done a little bit of the TV stuff, but mostly most of my career has been teaching.
Well, what is your experience with it? Because I know some of your books have been optioned and you know, maybe going to be made into a movie, which is fine. They give you some money and you're like,
yeah, I mean, that happens all the time. They get a tiny bit of money and somebody has an idea for a movie.
But wasn't there a point where you were kind of part of the process of making which one?
Well, there's always been talk about The Ask becoming a movie, but yeah. I did several years ago. I wrote a half-hour script
that
HBO bought, but nothing ever happened to it. But there was, I had this 2-week period when I thought I was about to become this really successful showrunner.
Yeah. And what happened?
And you can imagine me as a showrunner.
Like, what do I do?
And so it was almost like fantasy camp where like they make you can pay to, you know, $1,000 and pretend you're a showrunner for a week. That's what it felt like.
What happened with that?
They just, you know, they,
what was it called?
It was called People City. I wrote it in a couple weeks. Just my agent said, why don't you try writing something? And I did. And they bought it right away. And then I was, you know, going out to tea with movie stars to see if I liked them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. That, right. Oh yeah. Yeah. Sure.
And then the, you know,
who'd you go out with?
I had a nice time drinking tea with Michael Keaton.
Oh yeah. Oh, he's great.
He's great.
Yeah.
But then it was just this moment where they're like, who do you, you know, how do you see it, Sam? What, you know, how are you going to realize your vision? And then it was done.
Yeah.
But, and it was fine, but it was exactly the way it's supposed to go. It was like every story you ever hear about how it didn't work out.
Right. But did you leave doubting your vision?
I had written a funny script, but I had no idea what I was doing and had no place at that point doing, you know, it shouldn't have happened because I even didn't really have a vision for a whole show, you know?
Well, that's where you call your friend Mark.
Yeah.
And you go like, what do you think we should do with this?
I think I did call you.
Oh, maybe I wasn't ready. I think you did call me, but I'm like, I don't know. Do you want me to introduce you to somebody?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that it was just one of those things where they were deciding between a couple shows and they went.
Well, I think also what's happening now is that, like, oddly, when I get opportunities to do that kind of stuff, because of the podcast, or because, like, you know, you're teaching and you're still writing your books, is like, you really have to ask yourself, is like, do I want to throw fucking a year or two of my life and time down that fucking, you know, hole? Because, I mean, you can be locked into that shit for years and it doesn't go anywhere.
Right. You have to want to be doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to, that's what you needed to be chasing the whole time. And I'd kind of stumbled into it. And I wanted it to be like the old, my old idea of Hollywood with writers, where they just paid you some money for something and then told you to go away. But they were like, no, we want you to be
right
part of this.
Yeah. And now, but the, yeah. but I think the point that I'm trying to get to in my mind is that you can do something on television and movies that is now, because of the media landscape, they can immediately become equally as irrelevant as books.
Right, yeah.
You know,
there's
what I
mean? So like, much of it.
Right. Yeah. Like, you can do this amazing thing and nobody will see it.
Well, yeah, because it is like now it's the same thing, because I hear people, everyone's talking about a different show and they're saying, I haven't seen that. I haven't heard of
that. Right, yeah.
Where is that?
Right, that's right.
Oh, what are you talking about? It's the best thing on television. It changed my life. It's
right, that's the point I made earlier. Do you remember?
Well, I'm just catching up to it. I'm a little slow today.
Okay, well, that's a good point, Sam. I don't
know what you would do without my blazing insight about the cultural landscape. I mean,
no, I just like that we were so immersed in some other conversation then that when I brought it up, it apparently didn't register at all until you made it your own thought a half hour later. Well, that's
well,
good.
Well, when you first said it, I just said, file that away and bring it back as your own idea. Don't acknowledge that he's having a good idea.
Or that you understand what he's saying
just
in that moment.
Blow by it now. Circle back.
Let it go through your mill and drop it in where you feel like it's irrelevant. But
I am I'm doing some more stuff like that. I think I might play around with that kind of writing.
Well, good. But I got an email from somebody, and I can't remember, you know, what it, whether it was him or his daughter or something, but somebody had written to me, because I mentioned your name, and said that, you know, that either they were in your class or they said you're a great educator.
Well, that's nice to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the main part of my life. I've been teaching for 15, 16 years.
I remember
years.
When you started, though, and it was sort of like, I don't want to get sucked in. I don't want to.
Oh, I'm chair of the department. I mean, I'm sucked in.
But do you remember when you were struggling with the bureaucracy? You're like, I don't know if I can take
now
the politics.
Now I am the bureaucrat.
But what does that mean?
I'm the
exactly?
guy at the desk making, you know,
yeah.
making things difficult for.
But like, you didn't jockey for that. Was
no,
it
no.
a process of
no,
elimination?
It's a rotation, and everyone in the program, all the teachers have to take their turn doing this kind of administrative
work. Are you
going to
be like tenured or?
It's funny you should ask. After being there about 13 years, I'm going up for tenure this year. And
do they put you up, or you asked to be put up for it? How does that
I didn't ask, but they said, you know, we think you should go up for tenure. And so I am, but it's scary, because if something goes wrong with it, if you don't get tenure, you're out of a job.
What do you mean? Like, either you get it, you don't keep working?
They call it, you know, up or out.
Really?
So, yeah.
But why would you be out?
Because if once you go through that process, if you don't pass tenure, then you have to leave.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of fucked up system
is
that?
That's the academic system.
Even if you're a great teacher?
Well, I mean, I guess they're deciding that, but I mean, we'll see. Everyone who is in that world, not everyone, but a lot of people in that world have to go through this process, and it can be very scary for people, because usually they do it after 7 years or something like that, and then, you know, if they don't get tenure, then they have to leave and find another job.
Then you got to go to a smaller liberal arts college somewhere with a writing.
Well, if you're lucky, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the other thing is. My family, we live in Columbia housing where I teach. So it's kind of, it's all company town sort of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a little bit of that in the book too.
Yeah.
But it's a, what was it? What did they make at that place? Was it waffles or?
It's a waffle town. Yeah. Frozen waffle factory.
Yeah. The company town, man. It's like Stuyvesant Town was that MetLife or what was it?
I don't know what it was, but it was
the insurance
like
company. Yeah. I think. Yeah. But
A lot of my books, I'm always interested in the individual's relationship to institutions and to the way you're kind of sucked where you are sucked in, you know.
Well, but I think that it's sort of a beautiful thing that you did, you know, after a certain point in time, take to, you know, what the importance of what teachers are.
Well,
obviously.
Oh my God. I mean, absolutely. I mean, the thing is that I never imagined myself as a teacher when I was younger.
Right.
And I love teaching.
You
I
do?
Mean, yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I'm really, that's one of my happiest times is in the classroom.
Yeah.
You know, that to me is a refuge from everything. Now we're here and we're talking about stuff I care about and you care about, and we're all here, trying to get better as writers. That to me is really exciting. So that was always a thing of, some people have to write. Some people have to teach so they can write, and it's what a drag. But no, that's been really thrilling.
But that was an evolution for you.
Well, I had to find out that I was a teacher.
Right. But also you had to also, because I think that at the beginning, you know, that was the thought, that it was some sort of concession.
Yes, exactly.
That it was a necessity. If I wasn't going to sell out or try to do that or dilute myself or become desperate, you know, and have to pimp out or, you know, whore out my skills, you know, you teach, you know, like there's that model, you know, as somebody with a fiction writer, you know, always existed, but it also implied that on some level, I don't know if it's true or not, but that you weren't a success.
Yeah, well, that was the idea. Well, they always said those who can't do teach.
Yeah.
But in my world, like, everybody teaches.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But there's always that hovering over, and then you find out that you really love teaching.
Yeah.
Or what I did, anyway.
Well, that's great. And what do you try to impart in the kids in a general way, if you could, you know, in terms of approaching writing?
That nobody cares.
Is that the name of your first class?
That's the first class. That's good. If I ever write a book about, you know,
writing,
it'll be just called Nobody Cares.
Except you got to decide whether you do.
Yeah. Do you care? Chapter one. Do you care?
Do you care? And do you see the contraction academically in, you know, writing programs and the liberal arts in general?
Well, no. I mean, ours has been growing. I think a lot of people want to study this, and a lot of people that normally, because of various socioeconomic factors or others, felt shut out of these kinds of programs are kind of coming in and bringing new perspectives. And so, you know, there's more diversity in all ways. And so that's something that's, I think, great.
And do you find that most of the students are looking to, you know, build a life in writing fiction? Or do you think that, you know, that the
I think they're real, a lot of them are realists and see that it's not like 1972 right now.
Right.
And it's a different world out there for a literary novelist or a short story writer. And, you know, so I think some of them want to write books, but they're thinking, well, maybe I'll teach or maybe I'll find some other thing to do as well.
Right.
And I think a lot of them are, I mean, I remember this is a couple of years ago, I walked in on my class and they were already talking about stuff, and they were talking about all these writers and they were dropping all these writers' names, and I didn't recognize any of them. And I thought, oh my God, I'm really out of it. I'm not paying attention to what's happening in literature right now. And
yeah.
I really got to catch up. I'm really falling behind. And I kept listening, and then I finally said, who are these people? And they were all TV writers that they were talking about.
Oh.
So I think they're savvy and they understand that that's, you know,
but
a place that they need to look into as well.
And also because, you know, there's been a lot more space afforded that medium to explore, you know, more literary things.
Yeah, I mean, there you can do a lot of stuff there. It's not like, you know, we used to... But, you know, back in the day, you could only do things, you could do things in books that you couldn't do on TV. Now you can. So there's no content you can't do on TV.
And what do you
think? So
right.
Then the question is why, if that's the case, then why write a book? And it has to be because you care about language. It has to be because you care about that medium.
Right. And do you think that
because there's no story you can't tell on television, but what you can do in a book is capture the speed of thought and association and funnel it through poetic language.
Right.
And that's, so if you want to do that and that excites you and that has to be what gives you a charge, then you're in the right place to be writing. But I think that for all sorts of people fiction is a really still an exciting and liberating place to operate, both as writers and readers. And there is something that prose fiction can do that movies can't do. And I say this to my students when I'm teaching, when we're talking about even what they're doing in a specific scene, or saying, you know, would a movie do that better?
Yeah.
Because if a movie did it better, do something else.
Right. Yeah.
You know, if you're just describing a
know the battle.
I'm just like, is that just a reaction shot that you're giving us? Like, do something else, because we have a medium for that.
Yeah, well, you do. You tell them that?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's the way they think, I imagine, some of them.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So there's...
But just to say, I think that, you know, it will always find new relevance and new meaning for new generations. And people are still, you know, and maybe it's going away, but people talk about the internet, bad, you know, the bad internet and all that stuff. But the fact is that people through email and texting are writing all the time. And so in a way, even the idea of expressing yourself through language, through written text, is something that's still happening.
It happens more now in a way.
Well,
because less people want
to
talk.
Right, because it used to be just the telephone.
Right.
Now it's everyone's writing a treatise.
Yeah, everyone's
just to go out
misreading
to
the tone of text.
Exactly, right. Well, and then you have to learn how to be a better writer.
To be a good texter.
Just to be able to like meet your friend for coffee.
Okay, I'll let you have that. That seems like a good, you know... rationalization.
I mean, it's you know, borderline, but
it's good. It's solid. So have you decided on sections of the book that you're going to read when you go out and read your book? Hark.
I've been playing around with a few different ones, but you know, I think
you want to read one?
You want me to read something?
Yeah, read something. And then I want you to tell me on the mics that Jewish joke you told me the other day.
I'll just read the very beginning and then I'll read another little bit.
Okay.
Listen, before Hark, was it ever harder to be human? Was it ever harder to believe in our world? The weather made us wonder. The markets had, the wars. The rich had stopped pretending they were just the best of us and not some utterly different form of life. The rest, the most, could glimpse their end on earth in the parched basins and roiling seas, but could not march against their masters. They slaughtered each other instead, retracted into glowing holes. Hark glowed, too. He came to us and was goldeny. It wasn't that Hark had the answer. It was more that he didn't. All he possessed, he claimed, were a few tricks or tips to help people focus. At work, at home, out for coffee with a client or a friend. Listen, before Hark, was it ever harder to find focus? Hark gathered his tips together, called it mental archery. Pretty silly, he liked to say. But some knew better. Some were certain he had a secret. A mystery, a miracle. For what was mental archery but the essence of Hark, and what was the essence of Hark but love? In this hurt world, how could that hurt? The hunters of meaning had found no meaning. The wanters of dreams were dreamless. Many now drifted toward Hark Mourner. This is like the backstory. The front story is about a bunch of people and a movement they launched under the banner of Hark, a movement that maybe meant nothing at all, or maybe it did. It's tough to tell. The past is tricky, often half-hidden, like a pale, flabby young man flung naked into a crowded square. The past doesn't stand there, Grant ganders. The past clasps his crotch, scurries for the cover of stanchions, benches. History hides. That's its job. It hides behind other history.
Great. That's the opening of the book?
Yeah.
I'm in.
And then here's a little bit about one of the characters, Tova, and her kids.
Yeah.
Tova's on the train with the twins. She sits between them, keeps them yoked in relatively loose pro wrestler chokeholds. They are temporarily immobilized and thus unable to assault each other or fellow riders, both of which with these maniacs are possibilities, especially this morning. Meanwhile, she texts emendations to her supervisor's proposal to the provisional head of development at the Blended Learning Enhancement Project. Her supervisor, Cal, possesses what Tova knows the business community deems leadership qualities, meaning he's equal parts fool and lout, a human facsimile on a ceaseless quest to collect his salary and cover his butt. Apropos of which, the reason she's here on the subway restraining her kids in semi-legal grappler grips instead of already at her desk is because one or both of her children have, as she put it as concisely as she could on the phone to the doctor, concerns of the ass. More specifically, assworms. Tova may have assworms too. What happened was that all of their assholes started to itch, and Tova looked this symptom up, discovered a detailed photograph of a hairy, nearly microscopic worm. Somebody had earned enough trust from this creature to achieve a lively, candid shot, as the critter regarded the camera with unamused scorn, mostly expressed through what Tova supposed were eyes, but on further inspection might have been anal orifices themselves. Tova tried to call Fraz, but hasn't been able to reach him. He could be tutoring, or doing a favor for Mr. Dirch, or more likely, cleaning and jerking, perhaps at the gym, more likely at home.
Excellent. So funny, buddy.
Thank you, man.
And now, to close, I want you to tell me that joke again, because there's few jokes, like whatever my decision is and whatever the history of Jewish comedy is, but there's the joke I told John Cleese, you know, which is, you know, when he went in, he had a hat, you know, that bit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you? I don't think you told me that.
No, but that's, yeah. I've heard that joke.
Yeah, I probably told it to you. I would hope.
I think you did tell. Yeah, that's where I did hear it years ago.
Yeah. So what?
With the grandfather and the son on the beach.
Right. Yeah. So what's? Tell me the one you told me again, because I want to make sure.
I think
get
I might have heard this first from Gordon Lish.
Oh really?
20 years ago, but well, I'm not as good a joke teller.
No, you're great.
But there's an old man's dying.
Yeah.
And he's at home, and he's in his deathbed, and he's dying, and his grown son comes to see him and sits by his bedside and says, Dad, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. You've been such a good father. You've been such a wonderful dad. Is there anything I can do for you now? Do you need anything? Is there anything I can help you with, Dad? Is there anything I can do? And Dad says, oh, son, it's so good to see you. You're such a good boy. You're such a lovely boy. I'm just so glad you're here. I guess there's really nothing. Well, maybe there's one thing you could do for me, boy. Anything, Dad. Dad, just tell me anything. I'll do anything. Well, son, I smell your mother's chopped liver coming in from the kitchen, and it smells so good. She just makes the best chopped liver. And, son, I mean, I'm on my deathbed. I don't know how long I've got, but you think you could just go into the kitchen and get a little of that chopped liver and just put it on a cracker and bring it back to your old man? Do you think you could do that, son? And, of course, Dad, of course, anything. I'll be right back, of course. And the son leaves. A little while later, the son comes back, and he's empty-handed, and the dad says, son, what happened? Why don't you have the chopped liver? Why didn't you bring me back the chopped liver? And the son says, I'm sorry, Dad, but Mom says it's for after.
Yes, and that's it. That's the entire history of the Jews somehow, the American Jews.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. All right, buddy, it was good talking to you. Do you want to eat?
Yeah, we should eat.
What do you feel like eating?
No Greek this time.
Do you want to go over, see if we can sit down at the that Ross and Daughters Cafe?
Yeah, it looked pretty crowded, but I think we could.
What, you
check
walk by
out.
The one in Houston? No, they got a cafe. It's probably crowded down an orchard where you can sit at a table like a person and eat Jew food.
Okay, let's go eat some Jew food.
Okay.
Sam Lipsight and me talking into mics in a hotel room in New York City. Love it. Love him. The new novel is Hark. It's available for pre-order now. It comes out next Tuesday, January 15th. All right, so I will play guitar. Oh, man. Nothing original. ¶¶